The following talk was given at the Insight Meditation Center in Redwood City, California. Please visit our website at audiodharma.org.
So, hello everyone and welcome. Nice to have you here. And hopefully it's also nice for those of you here that it's nice to be with people. And for some of us it's been an unusual thing to do. Welcome, and for those of you on YouTube, I hope that someday we could be together. Someday you'll have maybe far away, you'll visit, and come here to IMC. We have people who do that periodically. It used to be before the pandemic. It seemed like almost every Sunday someone would come up and say, I'm visiting, I've been listening for a long time. So it's not very nice. So the topic for today is a little bit following up in a talk I gave maybe 4 or 5 weeks ago on Sunday that was in preparation for the 7 a.m. sittings I was doing, which was focusing on these different basic aspects of instructions for mindfulness meditation that we teach here. And at that time I said that something like that, that the basic instructions are not only basic for beginners, but they're also basic for people who would like to consider themselves advanced, and for those who are in between the two. That the basic instructions of the practice is the same. In fact, the Buddha, when he talked about this kind of thing, he said that before the first level of first experience of realization, the first level of awakening that people can experience, and after, the practice is the same. That what we're doing, the basic practice, doesn't change. And so, in a sense, in order doing the practice, it doesn't matter whether you're enlightened or not. It's still the same practice. And he even goes so far as to say when people become fully enlightened, even Buddhas, arhats, they still do the same practice in order to be able to be at ease in this world. We call it a pleasant abiding here and now. And also to encourage other people to practice. So the practice is the same before and after enlightenment. Isn't that kind of nice? So you don't have to worry about enlightenment when you're practicing. Because, you know, what good is it going to do you? You have to do the practice anyway. Before and after, you do it. And but it does some good, the practice. And when someone has a certain degree, clarity of letting go, of releasing something that's been they've been attached to for a long time, and it's clear enough and strong enough, then after that they have a reference point for the practice that's different. So the practice is the same, but the reference point for the practice changes. And the ancient language, the language is when now the practice is based on this reference point. And there are three reference points that they talk about that can happen. And this is where the difficulty of translating words from an Indic language to English, because the words in India are really rich. I mean, there's a long history of it, and I think they're inspiring words. In not just in Indian Buddhism, but in Indian language, even to the modern world sometimes. They're rich in associations. Whereas when you take and translate it literally into English, most of people who only know English are not going to feel, oh, wow, yeah, this is cool, this is wonderful. They're going to go, what? What? You know, sometimes at the best of it, right? It's going to be different. So I'll tell you the words in Pali, the Indic language first. And you, most of you won't have any sense of this, but some of you might have an Indian background. So it's Viveka, Viraga, and Nirodha. So the practice becomes based on those three, Viveka, Viraga, Nirodha. So the way that they're translated usually into English, that is not going to inspire you. I think maybe you will. I shouldn't be speaking for you. So maybe you'll be really jazzed to hear this. Seclusion, dispassion, and cessation. Is that kind of okay, or is that like, wow, you, now you're paying attention. Like, this is like fantastic. Seclusion, I can't wait. More seclusion. The pandemic has been not good, you know, it hasn't been long enough. Let's go really do it. It just justifies, you know, the pandemic, seclusion. So I don't think it really works in English to get a sense of how inspiring this is. And to hear that after some level of spiritual maturity in Buddhism, your practice gets based on those three, I think in English speakers doesn't really work. But I think that what might work, that I think is not a literal translation, but I think is a fair translation for these three terms, is independence, freedom, and peace. That, I think, in English, some people even have an emotional relationship to those three. And they speak a little bit more to people, you know, in English-speaking, maybe grew up in an English-speaking culture. And some of those words, you know, they are quite powerful in the United States. And then when I was growing up, there was a party. I think it still exists, right? The Peace and Freedom Party. And then independence. I mean, maybe there's problems sometimes because it lends itself to, sometimes it aligns itself with a kind of individualism that is selfish. Whereas, you know, to be too independent from everything else and just be myself and mine. But independence, you know, this country is like, the United States is kind of, you know, it's like one of the almost religiously political ideals, you know, my independence. It's a beautiful thing. Sometimes I've thought that this word viveka that I'm translating here as, you know, the seclusion, I'm translating as independence. I like the term English word autonomy. And sometimes to give people the autonomy to make their own medical decisions in this country is a really, I mean, it's a central feature of medical ethics. So the seclusion is to be secluded from attachments, from being enmeshed in the world of things and people and experiences and feelings that we might have, the thoughts and ideals and judgments we have. And so we're secluded from that entanglement. But another way of saying it is we become independent from it. Or something inside of us is independent from it. Something inside of us has become autonomous from us. There's an autonomy. So say you have a thought that goes through your mind, and maybe it's not a wonderful thought. And then you judge yourself. Oh, I'm a bad person. I shouldn't have done that. I hope there's no one mind reading here at IMC, because that'd be rather embarrassing that I had that thought. That reaction is an entanglement. We're caught in its web. We're involved in it and reacting to it and having preferences around it. To be autonomous or to be independent from our thinking is to see that thought arise and just see it arise and wave as it goes by, you know, or not wave, just let it, just have no reaction to it. Because there's some place inside, the place of knowing, of recognition, of awareness, that clearly is aware that this is happening. But it doesn't pick it up, doesn't react to it, doesn't, it's not for or against it, doesn't use it to define oneself. There was this terrible thought, and I am a lousy person because I had that thought. As opposed to the simplicity of, look, that was a lousy thought. Wow. Okay. Lousy thoughts come, lousy thoughts go. And there's no attachment. So there's a seclusion, there's a autonomy, there's an independence from those kinds of things, that kind of thought. Same thing with feelings. And this time I'll use a positive thing just so I challenge you some more. And that is, maybe there's a really happy feeling coming up. Now, who wants to be independent of that? But the happy feeling comes up, and there's an autonomy. We're aware of it, we're present for it, but there's an autonomy and independence from the happy feeling. The happy feeling is allowed to be there, but we don't define ourselves by it. Look at me, I got it made. You know, I hope they notice how happy I am because now I'm a good Buddhist or something. And because heaven forbid that you're depressed, because then how can you be a good Buddhist? But it doesn't matter what feelings are, depressed, happy, in this place of autonomy, independence. And it has a lot to do with the autonomy, independence of knowing, of being aware. There's a place inside, almost like a place inside, where we know what's happening. And I want to stress this idea of knowing. There's not shutting out the world. We know. And the knowing is free. The knowing is independent. So that comes to the second quality, which is, I translate as, or render it as freedom. So independence is the first one, or autonomy. And the second one is freedom, which is usually translated as dispassion. But what a dispassion means in the ancient language is no longer having attachments and the clinging. The word raga, which translates as passion here, has some of the negative connotations that we can have sometimes in English around the word passion. There's sometimes having too much passion, you know, he had a passion for his anger. Whoa, please. That's not good. Or passion for money or passion for status or wealth. We might talk that way sometimes. In California, maybe I don't know where else in the English-speaking world, the passion is kind of considered all good. You're supposed to have on your passion for life. So to talk about dispassion, it kind of doesn't quite work in this kind of, in the new. Passion used to mean suffering in the old days. That's from Latin, suffer. The passion of Christ was the suffering of Christ. So freedom, and it's freedom from clinging, from grasping, greed. It's freedom from ill will and hatred, and it's freedom from delusion. And delusion has a lot to do with the projections we put on the world, and then we believe those projections. And we, you know, there's human beings are kind of projecting machines. People, you know, walking, talking projectors. You know, we have all these ideas that we overlay onto the world and others. So some of those are deluded. And so as we develop this independent way of knowing, this autonomy of seeing, of being aware, and we're no longer so enmeshed in the experience, we can actually see thoughts, interpretations, projections arise in the mind. And we say, oh, that's just a projection. That's just, you know, who knows what that is? So you guys are all wearing masks. And I can think, you know, I bet you all have nice mustaches. Yeah, that's, you know, that's what it's, you know. So I would love to see your mustaches, and probably some are handlebar mustaches, and who knows. And I'm just seeing mustaches on, you know, all your faces. You know, because I can't see, you know, so I'm making up a story. So I, you know, I can see mustache story arising, and I see it's just a story, it's just an idea. And I don't, it's so easy to live in that story and assume that I'm seeing accurately. So the more independent we become from this aware place, it would be a fantastic vantage point to see the birth, the arising of an idea, and we can put a question mark behind it. Is it true? So this dispassion is this the fading away or becoming free from clinging. So some people would say it's a little bit, you know, a different way of talking about the first one. But here we're talking, we really feel the freedom. One, we feel kind of independent, and now we feel there's freedom. Oh, what a relief. It's so great to have this freedom, so great to not be caught. There's a joy, there's a delight, there's a sense of well-being, there's an appreciation of how great that is. And the third one, Nirodha, translated as usually, technically translated as cessation, means the stopping of something. It's a stopping of agitation. So calling it peace kind of works. There's a place of peace that we have. We know something about peace. In fact, peace is always present, believe it or not. It's just that if we're agitated, we can't notice it. There's more peace in this world than there is agitation. But we don't notice it because we're caught up in our swirls and thoughts and fears and, you know, ways. And so when someone has reached a deep enough letting go, let go of something, let go of their self-preoccupation, let go of their clingings, attachments, let go enough so that agitation has abated and they have an experience of themselves being unagitated. When it's been strong enough, that becomes ever available. It's always there if you turn towards it and see it. Oh, it's there. I might be agitated, but there's also peace. I might still be entangled, but there's also a place of independence where I see it, that I'm entangled. I still have these passions, these attachments, but I'm seeing it from a place that's not attached. So they kind of, the two work together as opposed to just being completely immersed in the world of attachment, immersed in the world of self-definition and selfing and all that. And so at that, so the practice is the same. It's a spirit, the mindfulness practice is very simple. It's just to be present clearly for what's happening in the moment. And I like to think that this mindfulness practice has a light touch to it. It's a light practice. It has no weight. But I certainly add weight to it. I bear down. I'm trying hard. I'm trying desperately to make it work. I'm trying to kind of... Sometimes I've had the bazooka approach to mindfulness. You know, I don't like what's happening, and I'm going to just blast it out of existence. I used to do that with knee pain. You know, like I just knee pain. If I just get really concentrated, I can just kind of like go beyond it, like blast it away or something. I could bear down. Or, you know, this mind is so agitated, like, you know, this is terrible. I shouldn't be this way. And, okay, I'm going to really kind of be mindful of my agitated mind, and I'm just going to make it go away or blast it away. So that's when there's a lot of weight and a lot of intensity and tension. But the mindfulness has this very light touch that has no weight. It clearly sees, clearly knows, but it's not reacting, doing. So learning that, and I like to think that mindfulness practice is very simple. We always try to keep things simple. So being aware, thinking, I'm thinking. Just thinking. And then we do it again, thinking, thinking. Really see it. And then we might see that we're tense around our thoughts. We see tense. We see we have preferences around thinking. Preference. See that we're recoiling from our thoughts. Oh, this is recoiling. And And then we say, you know, then we notice, oh, I'm breathing. In addition to all these thoughts I'm having, oh, it's just breathing. And then there might be a choice. I think that rather than thinking about these things, what if I just stay with my breath? And just stay, I can stay 2 or 3 breaths. That was nice. And then my mind wanders off. At some point you notice that the mind wanders off, and then it's just a wandering off mind. And then there's breathing again. Breathing in and breathing out, breathing in and breathing out. And then now I can stay longer with the breath. And then it occurs to me, you know, if I kind of relax in my torso and my belly, I think I can stay with the breath longer. And so we stay longer and longer. And so slowly things kind of come together. And at some point, this process of simplification comes to a place where something releases, something lets go enough, something quiets enough or stills enough that we discover this place, or that place is not really the right language. We discover something that feels independent, free, and peaceful. And wow. Now one option then is to cling to that. I want that, more of that. I'll hold on to this. So then the simple practice of mindfulness, you notice wanting, tension, headache arising because of peace and freedom. You know, and you know how much a loss of peace that happens as we cling and want more of the peace and try to make it come back or something. So we learn all these tricks of the mind. We learn what the mind does to all this that makes it more complicated than it needs to be. But you know, if we come together and we practice, and so someone who has some level of maturity in Buddhism, the practice is the same as someone who's a beginner, but they have this reference point that they can kind of feel or sense or know or remember that there's this potential, this capacity to know. Well, in the knowing, there's this independence, this freedom, and this peace. And so the practice, what the practice of mindfulness is the same, it's just the reference point for it, the support for it, the context for doing it shifts. So that's the big change. And so sometimes it's said that, and when we do mindfulness practice, there's a little slogan that says, it's not seeing something new, but seeing in a new way. So it's not necessarily that we live in a world and see the world differently, but we see with these eyes or with perception that doesn't cling. We see with these eyes that it feels independent. It's not enmeshed with or tangled with, so it's independent. We see with, perceive with a capacity that there's this freedom in the being with something, not caught in it. And there's peace rather than agitation as we see. The eyes that see are calm as opposed to darting around and, you know, being afraid or something or wanting. And so that's the big shift. And then you have some hint of that. It feels traces of that. And then this is to be appreciated and valued. Some people don't hear that message, and so they just think it's always the same practice, and so they will keep focusing on what's happening in the moment, not understanding that how they focus, how they're aware, is actually more important than what they're aware of. You have to be aware of something in this world of ours, usually, as we go about our life. But how we're aware of it, can how we are be independent, free, and peaceful. And if it can't be, which it often isn't, can how you know that be independent, free, and peaceful? And you keep stepping back. You keep stepping. Where can I find that place? Where can I step back and just see, okay, this is how it is. So in terms of mindfulness meditation, then it's always, like when we actually do meditation, it's always the same practice, but the practice, what we're aware of, also shifts as we practice. There's a simplification process that goes on. And the Buddha talked about this simplification process that leads us to become simpler and simpler and simpler, and then we get turned inside out, and this is my language, inside out, so that we can, when we come back into the world, we're back in the world in a simple way, but we're free. And so again, it's not a rejection of the world, it's a kind of a learning how to be in the world in a whole different way. So there's one discourse that's called the Lesser Discourse on Emptiness, which I think it should be translated the Lesser Discourse on Emptying, because there is a process of simplifying that goes on. So I wanted to give you a little example of this. So this morning, before I came down to IMC, my mind was thinking about being here at IMC this morning. You know, we had this COVID protocol, and I'm going off to teach retreat today, and so I had to get some things from here. I wanted to be here early enough to make sure that everything was in place. There was some of my responsibilities here had to be fulfilled, take care of things before I left. And then there was this talk I was supposed to give, and who's going to come, and do I have the right mask, and, you know. And I was comfortable and peaceful enough about it, but my mind was in this complicated world, thinking ahead, planning ahead, what do I have to do, the list of things, and that was the complicated world I was living in, kind of a little bit coming down here. Once I came here, I didn't have to be thinking about what am I going to do when I get to IMC. I was at IMC. And so now I just went around and started taking care of the things I had to do. And I still was thinking ahead a little bit, you know, what's next, and do I have time to do everything? But I was, you know, then it was simpler. I was just doing them. I was here, and it was just, you know, it was just a simpler world than the complicated projections of that. And so I was taking care of things. It was nice. And then at some point I could meditate with all of you. And then, you know, then, okay. A lot of things were taken care of, and yeah, there are things to do afterwards as well, but now I don't have to think about that anymore. And now I could feel that I'm still, the momentum of having all those thinking was still going on, but that momentum just feels like energy, a little agitation, a little tightness someplace in my chest. It's okay. I'll just breathe with it and be with it and feel it. And then I could feel there started to be a shift, and my thinking got quieter. And I stopped thinking about IMC and the tasks I had to do, and even with the eyes closed, the fact that I was even sitting at IMC in this building kind of receded. Occasionally I had thoughts about, when do I have to ring the bell? Should I look at the clock? I finally did, and I was late. So a little bit of things came through, but things got simpler and simpler, and then And then after a while, I could feel a shift inside, I kind of dropped into my body. And it was more with my body and the simplicity of just breathing. And there was very little thought going on, just breathing and simple. And that process, if it continued, could get more and more simple. And, you know, after a while, maybe the breathing would have kind of gotten quieter and calmer, that I couldn't even feel the breathing. And it was just more feeling sensations in my body. After a while, sometimes when I meditate, the sense of the boundaries of the body, the sense of it being in a body as a bounded thing disappears, and the body just feels porous to the environment, or, you know, boundaryless almost. There's times when my body's disappeared in meditation, and I kind of felt so much like I was invisible. And I, when the first times it happened, I opened my eyes to make sure I was still here. Yep, it hadn't gone anywhere. But the simplification that goes on. And one of the, and it's not valuable just to have it that simple, except that it's kind of relaxed and calm. What's valuable is what it teaches us about non-clinging. He said, "Oh, because I was, you know, there, when it's more complicated, it tends to be more clinging, more attachment and stuff. But you kind of all those get shed and get quieter, and it takes a lot to trust. Have this deep trust that it's okay to let go of the things we're attached to. Let go in terms of in meditation. Let go of thinking about it and being concerned about it. It takes a lot of love and care not to criticize yourself if you can't let go. And you know your mind is just swirling and whirling by itself. And probably that's a time when you probably need a lot of compassion and care and love and kindness and generosity and to trust it's okay. And that trusting it's okay to be agitated is a great help for getting calm. So this trusting and finding ourselves. And so there, as we trust and relax and just trust the present moment, just it's enough just to be alive in the present moment, breathing and being. At some point you get a sense of independence. We get a sense of freedom. We get a sense of peace. And if that experience is impactful enough, strong enough, some remnant of it, some traces of it, some memory of it remains there. And then the Buddha said, this course, Lesser Discourse on Emptiness, you go through this whole process of emptying, simplifying, becoming less. And then he takes us back into the world. And he's going to more and more reified, sublime kind of meditation states. But then he says, and the most ultimate, the most ultimate thing is to be back in the world with hearing, seeing, tasting, touching, being aware of your thoughts, what goes on in the mind. Just being in the world without any clinging. And then you're just aware, then you practice the same. Aware of your thoughts, what you see, what you hear, what you feel, what you sense, what you taste, what you're thinking, what you're feeling. You know, all these things are still there. But then there's a different reference point. So it's possible that some of you already have a reference point for that. Maybe something happened for you, a time in your life that was independent, outside of meditation. Maybe you were in some setting, some situation where you had some profound experience of being at peace, being at home, being at ease. Some people have it in a natural setting, in a park or by the ocean or in the mountains or something. Some people have it with other people. Sometimes in lovemaking, some people will have that with that experience. Some people, it's listening to music, you know, in some kind of nice way, maybe at home alone. Or some people, it's through playing music or dance or exercise or having a good nap and waking up in a peaceful setting. So, you know, there's so many different ways. But maybe if you've had some experience. An experience that, I had a number of experiences, a few experiences as a child growing up that kind of remained for me, kind of like as a touchstone. And one of them was we had this, I guess, relatively small dining room table. And sometimes I would take these white bed sheets that we have and put it over the table. And then I was a little kid, so I would crawl underneath, inside, and the light from the sun would be coming into the kitchen, and the light was so sublime, beautiful, and clear, and kind of, I don't know what to say, clean or something, coming through the white sheet, and I'd feel so cozy and safe from the world, protected, secluded. it's such a nice way. And I still feel it in my body, this physical sense of kind of well-being that came from that kind of way of being. And the Buddha also had a childhood story like that. That wasn't under the kitchen table, but it was a similar kind of childhood experience that became his reference point for how he then followed the path to his awakening. So maybe you have a reference point already. Maybe something happened to you. Maybe something from when you were five. I think that's how old I was, maybe, with the kitchen thing. And some reference point for what we're talking about here. So that when you practice, that reference point is close by. It's kind of like a little reminder, a little pointer to, oh, that's possible. That's a way of being with this. As opposed to when I was in Japan, in the Zen monasteries, sometimes the abbot would bark like a drill sergeant. Concentrate! Concentrate! Concentrate as if your head's on fire. Die! Die! Now, you know, if I took that as the only reference point for the attitude for how to sit and meditate, I probably would have given myself a headache. So, you know, some people grew up with taskmasters, teachers or parents or somebody that kind of imbued a certain kind of attitude that became the reference point for how to be, that not so healthy. So I think what Buddhism is suggesting is that there is a way, a healthy way, to have reference points of experiences we've had in life that are really healthy and wholesome and good, and not try to desperately have it again, engineer it again, but to kind of intuit it, or kind of remember the quality of the mind, the attention, the heart, so that when you start doing mindfulness practice, that's kind of the tone, that's the feeling, that's the way that this light touch in which we use mindfulness. That the mindfulness, the attention is somehow, you know, oriented a little bit to be that way, or it's like a North Star, or it's like a reminder. You don't have to be so tense. You don't have to be trying so hard. You don't have to be so you don't have to confuse mindfulness with judgments, with preferences. Just it's okay to be simple. It's okay to be really simple. And I think it's good, and then I'll end by saying that it's a beautiful thing to be independent, free, and peaceful, because then there's generosity in our way of being with the world, a particular generosity, and that is the generosity of granting everything else its freedom. So then we're with someone, we're not meeting them with them, you know, being entangled with them, or them needing them to be a certain way, or wanting them to be a certain way, or imposing upon them our agitation or our agendas. We can, being able to be with someone fully and kindly and presently with a degree of independence, so they can be independent, with freedom, our inner freedom, so that we're not complicating their life and taking their freedom away, so that we are peaceful, so that there's a possibility for them to be peaceful. Our agitation is not necessarily agitating them. And that's true with people, it's true with things and animals and beings and everything. We grant everything its freedom. Isn't that nice? In the end, maybe you don't get liberated. Maybe you've liberated everything from you. And that's your gift. So thank you all very much for today. And then we will... So next week, Max Ernstein is coming to speak. And very happy to have him come and be here. And I'll be back the following week. And then the week after that, Matthew Brentzeller will come and give the talk here in person. So I don't know if any of you will sign up but to come for that. And then I want to say that depending on what direction this COVID infections go, if it goes in a good direction, then I will probably change a little bit the registration, what we do here. Maybe have a few more people come on Sundays, or so we might change something. We might change the Sunday schedule a little bit so that the first sitting starts at 8:30 rather than at 8. So some people might want to come then because it's a little bit later. And so you have to be sure you read. You all get the announcement, I guess, to sign up. And so you have to be sure you read. That's where we'll explain how it changes. In the beginning of each month, we'll probably change what we're doing. And those of you on YouTube, if you live locally, in order to get that email with instructions about how to come here in person, you have to register your COVID card to show us that you're vaccinated. And you'll find that information on the What's New on IMC website. So thank you very much, everyone.